in a five-session series dealing with the historical Jesus and whether the historical Jesus can find a place within Christianity. How many of you, is this your first session? Okay, I kind of figured that. How many of you have been to more than two? Okay, so some of you have been kind of following all along the way. Well, as I was putting together what I'm going to do tonight, I kind of assumed that we would have quite a few new people. And so I have just kind of framed what I'm going to do in that context. But let me just say, for those of you who are coming for the first time, it's a pretty provocative title, and maybe that's why you've come. A Bad Day for Jesus, Crucified, Eaten by Dogs. And I will get I will talk to you about the very likelihood that what happened to Jesus' body after he was crucified is that he in fact was eaten by dogs. So I will talk to you about that, why that may be true, why it's historically likely. But before I do that, what I want to frame tonight's conversation around is the whole issue of violence in the time of Jesus. Violence and really nonviolent resistance, and how Jesus fits within the sociological framework of his time. How he lived in the midst of Roman violence, how he lived in the midst of whether he was different or similar, or the ways he was different and similar to other Jewish movements that were resisting Roman occupation and the collaboration of their own priestly group. If you're here for the first time, one of the things I've talked about is that there were two pillars of power dominating the life of impoverished people, accounting for their oppression for those who lived in Palestine. One was Roman power, Roman authority, and the other was the temple. And the high priest was a political appointee of Rome. We have an interesting collaboration in dealing with Jesus' specific time, because during Jesus' time, Pilate was a direct Roman governor over the region. So there was direct, not indirect rule, but direct rule. And the high priest of the time, Caiaphas, held the record for the longest period of rule by a high priest. And what that means in the context of what I've said earlier is he was very compliant with Rome. He did his job very well of representing Roman interests as being the highest official within Judaism. Okay, if someone would maybe just get that door and close it, that would be wonderful. And if we had the time, I would focus a lot more time on what I'm going to do in the next 3 or 4 minutes with you out loud. But I want you, in a brainstorm format, to throw out to me, to think about our own world, in particular our own society. And I want you to throw out for me all kinds of examples of violence that we see in our own society. Okay? All kinds. Any kind that comes to your mind.
Mass execution in Bosnia.
Okay?
Advertisement.
Bombings.
What's that?
Bombing.
Bombings.
Rape.
TV
violence. What else?
Domestic abuse.
Domestic abuse.
Gangs.
Sports.
Sports and gangs. What else?
Is this against people, or how about environmental?
Okay, that's fine too. But so environmental kinds of violence against the environment.
Verbal abuse.
Emotional. Drugs.
Sound music.
Nuclear weapons.
Discrimination.
Food
as a weapon? Is that what you're... Okay.
Burning churches.
What's that?
Burning churches.
Good.
Racial violence.
The various street crimes.
Okay.
Muggings and stabbings.
Street violence.
Terrorism.
Cosmetics. Oil industry.
legalized executions by the state.
Okay.
And child abuse.
Okay, well, we can probably stop there, but I want to do, before we just get dragged down, it's a pretty hefty list, and there's a lot that we could add to it. I just wanted to give us a sense of how pervasive violence is in our own society, and how diverse it is. And now what I'd like to do is to try to build on... Nice eraser, huh? Build on some insights that grow out of the church in Central America and Latin America. And in many ways, people sometimes say when we're studying, looking at the New Jesus scholarship, some critics would say, well, we don't have anything else to go on. There's nothing new. Well, how can we have New Jesus scholarship when we've just got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and a few other things? There's nothing new. And one response to that that I've already given is that there's a whole lot better sociological studies, anthropological studies, all kinds of studies that get at understanding the kind of society that Jesus lived in. That's one thing. But another thing that we have, and I think this is really important, is we have now the records of people reflecting upon Scripture who lived in situations pretty similar to those that the vast majority of people in Jesus' time lived. I've talked about in Jesus' time, 90% of the people were poor. 10% were powerful, especially 1% or 2%. Land was highly concentrated. People were being driven out off their land by debt. A whole series of things. Well, that's the reality for huge numbers of people living in places like Central Latin America. And it helps, I think, us to better understand the social setting of Jesus. And one of the really important contributions, I think, that has come out of liberation theology, which has emerged out of Central Latin America as well as elsewhere, is their understanding of violence. And they talk about a spiral of violence. And making up the spiral that they talk about are three main things. The first, violence, and no one really said this directly, I don't think, is the violence of oppression, hunger. Hunger and poverty are violence. Oppression, misery, that's violence. They call that violence number one. And then they say violence number two is when poor people who are being crushed try to resist somehow. Sometimes they resist with stones, sometimes they resist, demonstrate, sometimes they take up arms. So it's the poor resisting their oppression, crying out, trying to bring about some kind of social change. And the third violence is state-sponsored violence. The violence of the military, the violence of the police, in the cases of Central America, the violence of the paramilitary death squads. I lived in Central America for a number of years in the 1980s. And actually, again, I'll just mention this, is a book called War Against the Poor up there that gives my analysis of this spiral of violence. And so these are three levels of violence. And what church people, at least some church people, some religious people, who are part of base Christian community movements, connected with the poor. Their take on violence is that if you want to end violence, you have to break this spiral. And the way you do that is you really have to attack violence number one. You have to deal with hunger. You have to deal with poverty. You have to deal with oppression. And they also called upon the church to delegitimize the state violence. In other words, that the armies of illegitimate governments who are repressing their people should not be supported, theologically or in any other way. Okay? So this spiral is really, really helpful in understanding our own time, it seems to me, as well as the time of Jesus. Now, I have added a fourth. In my own analysis of what's going on, I've added a fourth, and I don't know where it comes in the spiral. I'm not sure, probably somewhere over here. But I just call it, I had a nicer name for it, but for tonight, I'll call it deflective. deflective/destructive violence. And what I mean by deflective, destructive violence is this is the violence of our nightly news. Okay, people living in poor communities around the country killing each other. Kids getting killed because someone's stealing their shoes. Crime. There's a whole lot of, it's violence that grows out of destitution. It's violence that grows out of poverty. It's violence and meanness that's created because of the absence of hope. But it's not targeted. It's not confronting a system. It's not challenging the powers that be. It doesn't have an articulated program for something different. It's just, for the most part, awful, ugly, destructive, in which usually poor people are killing poor people. Okay? And I think that's also an important category in terms of understanding understanding Jesus. Tonight, I'm going to get back. I've been using Crossan quite a bit as a reference point for this class, his book, Jesus, A Revolutionary Biography. Tonight, I'm going to recommend another book that I've mentioned before, but I'll draw on it more for tonight. It's Richard Horsley, who has done, I think, the best studies looking at the actual life setting, the political, economic, social, religious setting in which people lived during the time of Jesus. And this is the book called Jesus and the Spiral of Violence. So what was the spiral of violence like in Jesus' time is what he looks at. And in particular, he focuses on various forms of popular resistance to the violence of particularly the Roman state. Well, what I want to do is I want to give you four or five examples of Jewish resistance to imperial power, okay, during or pretty close to the time of Jesus, and then from there, I'm going to look at how Jesus lived and acted, why it got him killed, and then we'll look at this question of Jesus. In fact, did have a very bad day, and did it include what? What might it have included in terms of what happened to his body and why that might be important? Okay, any questions so far or comments? You kind of basically with me so far? Okay. All right. Let me just do this fairly quickly. The eyes go at 43 is what I discovered. I had perfect vision until 43. I mentioned last time, and maybe a couple times ago, that the priestly story is one of the stories that we get in Scripture, looking at the world through their lens. And generally their lens, their interpretation of things is, we're sick because we're sinful, we're in exile because we're sinful. If we're being dominated by foreign powers because we haven't been holy enough, etc. That was part of that priestly story. But there was another part. It wasn't a monolithic group, this priestly group. And we have some really strong examples of priests resisting imperial domination, resisting the kind of reforms that were required that involved some of the things I've mentioned before, whether it be emperor worship, or whether it be constructing temples to the emperor, or whether it be setting up coliseums where the sport for the local crowd was to watch people being eaten by lions, etc., or not being able to practice your religion, etc. So one example that I would give is from the period it's written about in the book of Daniel. And there you have the priestly class really leading a kind of faithful resistance to this domination and being slaughtered. And I give you that example because it's an important example to remind us that not all priests gave up on their faith and in fact became collaborators with Rome or collaborators with foreign power. I also mention it, and I'll come back to this maybe late tonight or maybe tomorrow afternoon in the last session, because again, it's out of that context that the idea of the resurrection first emerges within Judaism as a central theme. In other words, that explanation that the priests had offered for decades, that we're in this miserable state because of our sin. You know, God's punishing us. That's why the Babylonians had conquered us, or the Romans, or whoever. Simply didn't hold up anymore. And part of, again, a term I used in the past, and you can listen to a previous tape, I talked about the apocalyptic vision. And part of the apocalyptic vision was that God would set things straight, that God was in control despite all of the appearances that a foreign, all the power that an empire might have, God was still in control, and in the end it's going to work out, and those that are faithful will be vindicated. So the idea of resurrection emerges out of this intense persecution of the faithful, and that becomes very important in terms of how the death of Jesus is understood by some of his priestly followers as they tell us the story. Okay, so that's one example. A second example, there were several scholars of the Torah that in the year 4 BC, 4 years before the birth of Jesus, and at this time Herod, who was the client king appointed by Rome to maintain Roman interests in Palestine, was very sick. And because he was sick, resistance against him got to be a little bit more bold. And there were two teachers of the Torah who got together with some of their students, and in a very profound symbolic action, in the middle of the night, they climbed up and they ripped down this huge statue of the Roman eagle that Herod had allowed to be placed, basically overlooking the sacred place of Judaism, the temple. Now, we could talk in our own country about symbolic actions. There's been a lot. Maybe you've participated in some symbolic action, symbolic resistance. One that I remember when I was in college was when people burned draft files in protest of the Vietnam War. They weren't killing anybody. They weren't hurting anybody. But they were symbolically focusing on a very important issue in a lot of our lives at the time, which was the draft, right? And a war that was going on. And that symbolic action reflected a lot of resistance. I mean, it symbolized a lot of anger and frustration that was building against the war and trying to make it more visible. Well, that was this act. And very importantly, the way that Herod responded to this threat was he rounded up the two scholars and the students that did it and burned them alive. Okay, that was Rome's response. Carrying on, still 4 BC, Herod dies. And I mentioned this before, there was an uprising in a fairly substantial city of Sepphoris. And the uprising was among the Jewish people who were very upset that Herod's sons, who had been appointed now as the client kings for the region, basically wouldn't meet any of their demands. They wanted a new high priest, that was one of their demands, because they knew that the high priest collaborated with Rome. They wanted those responsible for burning these teachers and students alive to be brought to justice. They wanted a reduction in the taxation that was being imposed on the people. Very concrete, specific demands, but they got instead tremendous repression at the hands of Herod's sons, and that prompted it prompted a major rebellion at the time of Herod's death, right around that time, throughout all of Palestine. And that's the one, if you were here, I told you the story, that for a time these Jewish resistors in this spontaneous uprising actually gained control of Sepphoris for a little while. And then Rome sent in its legions from neighboring Syria and burned the city to the ground. And some scholars speculate that the maimed and the lame that we read about in the gospel story are the survivors of Sepphoris. And in the aftermath of Sepphoris, what did the Romans do? They crucified 2,000 people, lined them up on the streets, and left their bodies to rot, to be eaten by dogs and other wild birds, as a sign that you don't resist Rome. You just don't do it. It's a kind of symbol of terror. Another example. How many of you have heard of the Zealots? A few of you. In the 1960s and early 70s, when I was in seminary, a lot of people talked about the Zealots as being this, that Jesus was an alternative to the Zealots. Well, in fact, the Zealots didn't exist at the time of Jesus. The Zealots formed during the war between Rome and the Jews during 66 to 70 when the temple was destroyed. So there was not an organized armed rebellion against Rome during the time of Jesus. But there was a group called the Sicarii. And the Sicarii, you mentioned again, another form of violence, terrorism. What the Sicarii did is Sicarii I think literally means beggar, I'm not sure. But what they did is in the light of day, in public places, they would be strolling along and they would come up to a particularly visible religious official within Judaism who was a collaborator with the Romans and assassinate them with their daggers in public. They were known as the Sicarii. It was a terrorist hit squad, basically. They were around. That was a kind of a small group that were involved in violence that was really a violence against Rome, but they targeted who they deemed to be the collaborators with the Romans. Another movement, and this was very close to the time of Jesus, Horsley calls the Fourth Philosophy. And the Fourth Philosophy, they got very strong in their resistance at the time when Herod's sons, remember I told you that Herod's sons were appointed now as the client kings? They weren't doing a very good job. They couldn't maintain order. And what the Romans did when that took place is they got rid of them. And they put their own direct governors to govern. And what that meant for people living in Jewish Palestine, it may not sound like a big difference to us, but it was just enough to push you over the edge. I talked last time about how difficult it must have been to experience or celebrate Passover, freedom, when you're looking around and there's Roman soldiers all over the place, reminding you that you're not free. Well, in the same way, it was difficult to live with a client king, and it was difficult to live with the fact that the temple would collect taxes and then siphon them off to Rome, part of what they did. But now, for the first time in a long time, you had direct Roman rule and you had direct Roman taxation. And out of that came a fourth philosophy that really what it encouraged the people to do was tax resistance. Refuse to sign up for the tax census. Refuse to pay your taxes. And so there was a whole nonviolent movement around the direct taxation issue. And then one more that I'll mention. There are many more. But occasionally, and Pilate was one of these. By the way, the story that we have about Pilate in our scripture is a real good example of why we have to look critically at what scripture tells us. Because Pilate, what does Pilate do in the trial scene? He washes his hands and he's saying, no, I can't find any fault. And he basically comes out looking like a pretty good guy, right? And really it's the Jews that are forcing him to do this, and finally he acquiesces. In fact, Pilate was one of Rome's most brutal governors. And there are numerous instances in the history of this period written down by Josephus in which Pilate sends his troops on and slaughters thousands and thousands of people. So we have a very apologetic view. In one instance involving Pilate was apparently he decided to allow Roman soldiers to come into Jerusalem with their standards on their shields. And the standard is basically was an engravement of your God. Okay? In this case, probably Octavius, declared a Roman emperor, declared god. I don't know what was on the standard, but it would have been one of the Roman gods. And when he did this, it outraged the Jews, because part of, again, their tradition was you don't have graven images. You don't allow that. You don't have images. So this was clearly a very provocative affront to the people. And so what they did is hundreds and thousands of them marched to the governor's residence and had a sit-in protest. And I think after 3 days or something like that, Pilate says, are you prepared to make war with me? And they say, no, we won't make war with you, but we are prepared to die. And Pilate orders his soldiers to take out their swords, and upon taking out their swords, these thousands of people all plop down on their knees and stick out their necks, ready to have their heads chopped off. And in that case, Pilate actually recounts and says, okay, lets them go, and then orders the soldiers whatever, out. Okay, so I'm trying to give you a framework that there's a whole lot of violence going on, and there's a whole lot of resistance going on. And now I'd like to spend a few minutes and talk about where Jesus fits into this. Okay, any again, questions or comments so far? Anything that's not clear or sounds weird or anything? Okay, another reminder from an earlier tape. One of the predominant visions that the people had, given the situation of living under imperial rule, and which the religious officials have become collaborators with Rome, is the apocalyptic worldview. And the apocalyptic worldview, in a nutshell, again, is simply that what's happening in the world around us is out of control. That basically nothing we can do humanly is going to change that. But we believe with all of our hearts that God is in charge. And we are expecting and we believe that a new imminent coming of God is going to happen really soon. And God's going to throw the Romans out, and a vengeful God is going to come, throw the Romans out, cleanse the temple, and basically set things straight. Now, this is very interesting because they had all kinds of different expectations of that. For example, I don't remember the name, but Horsley describes there were numbers of movements that basically reenacted the Exodus event. They cross over the Jordan, come back over expecting liberation, only to be slaughtered by the Romans. Or they reenacted the Jericho event, nonviolently surrounding Jerusalem with the full expectation and promise of their leader that if they do that, the walls of Jerusalem are going to come tumbling down because this avenging God is going to come and set things right. All they have to do is prepare themselves, be faithful, and reenact their story from the past. Very interesting. And in almost every case, they were slaughtered. They were slaughtered. That was Rome's response to these kind of threats. Round them up, crucify them, leave their bodies in public places, etc. So crucifixion for Rome is what was state terrorism. We'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, so this is the environment that Jesus is walking in. It's not a very easy environment, right? And I think one of the things that the New Jesus scholars, one of the things that they try to have us come to terms with is just how brutal the state terror was and how easy it was, or how uneventful it was that Jesus should be crucified. It wasn't an unusual event. That's what Rome did at the sign of an agitator getting out of control. John the Baptist is executed because of the fear that he's creating all these seditious people through baptism. And it's not surprising that Jesus eventually shares that fate. Okay, so that's the world that Jesus is walking into, and that's the world in which, as I talked about last time, Jesus does a lot of very provocative things. But he's not a Sicarii, right? And he's not a zealot that comes later. He is attempting to undermine the present social order by living differently at every turn. And so we talked about healing. We talked about how he eats and breaks down boundaries with all these people. His movement apparently was primarily among rural people. Rural people and in small towns and villages. Where basically what they're doing is they're re-establishing community life around different rules. Where priestly authority is being undermined. Where the power of the people to embrace God's grace directly outside of the establishment of the synagogue or outside of the establishment of the temple is reaffirmed. Where new leadership emerges, the new definition of the family comes about, where the family is not the patriarchal dominated, male dominated relationship of the household of power over others, but it in fact is people who are living out this this new way of being, this way of sharing, this way of giving life to each other. Well, I'd like to read to you a kind of classic misinterpreted passage. And if any of you are familiar with the work of Walter Wink, or you're interested specifically in Jesus and Nonviolence, I commend a book by Walter Wink called Engaging the Powers. It's the best single book on Jesus and Nonviolence that I know of. And he takes this classic text, which I'm sure many of you have heard before. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist one who is evil. And this is the translation we have. We'll get at that in a minute. But I say to you, do not resist one who is evil, but if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your coat, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to him who begs from you, and do not refuse him who would borrow from you. You all familiar with that passage? How has that passage generally been interpreted?
It's generally spiritualized.
Okay.
So, it seems so appropriate for us.
Okay, so we don't like to take it on its face value, so we look for an alternative, so we attempt to spiritualize it. Okay, I think that's true. That's one option. What's another option?
It seems it's very pacifist. Sorry.
Or very passive.
Passive.
Yeah.
In the pacifist sense.
Do not resist. Yeah, I think by and large we've either ignored or spiritualized or misinterpreted the passage. That's what Walter Wink would say as well. And he would say, you know, how can we reconcile, how can we get a meaning out of this of Jesus saying don't resist evil, given everything I've said in the last four sessions, right? Where Jesus is constantly resisting evil. He's constantly standing up to the unjust authorities. He's constantly challenging Rome and the high priests and the sin system and breaking down barriers. It just doesn't really fit, right? That interpretation of Jesus is telling us here, in the face of injustice and evil, just to sit there and be quiet. Well, here's what Walter Wink helps us to very quickly. I'm just going to go through and kind of interpret this passage of how it might make sense in the context in which Jesus lived. First, would you stand up and just help me for just a second?
Mm-hmm.
What I'd like you to do, the passage says here, if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, I would like you to strike me on the right cheek. How would you do that? Okay,
right.
Use your left hand. Okay, now if you were to use your right hand, how would you do it? Okay, it would be a backhanded slap. Thank you. Now, did you ever wonder, you may want to hit me harder than that once I get to the eaten by dogs part. We can go to that again. But have you ever wondered in this passage why it says, if anyone strikes you on the right cheek? What's going on here is that this is not a fist fight. This is a shaming. This passage is addressed in each of the cases. You know, who's being dragged into court? Who's being hit? Who's being forced to walk an extra mile? These are all vulnerable, poor people who are basically at the whims of the powerful and are in incredibly vulnerable positions in terms of how they respond. Okay? And so this, we're talking here about an insult, and it would have been very common in the kind of pyramid culture that I've talked about before, where you have real clarity about who's in charge and who isn't, and the vast majority of people are either non-persons or very marginal persons, and they're constantly struggling to survive in relation to a patron that's above them, and they're trying to find a way of surviving in the midst of this unequal power. And so this is an insult. This would be a very common occurrence. Think about slavery days or think about other things where someone is being whacked across the right cheek because someone superior to them is putting them in their place. Okay? Now, here's the interesting thing. Your initial thing was to hit, I don't know if you're left-handed. Was to hit with your left hand. That would be another way of getting someone in the right cheek. But in the culture of the time, the left hand is the unclean hand. You don't use your left hand. And so to do that, if this were a fist fight and you were to smash me with your left hand, you in fact have dishonored yourself. And in honor culture, these things are very important. So we're not talking about a fist fight. So when Jesus says, if someone hits you on the right cheek, offer the other one too, now you've put them in a very vulnerable position, because either they do have to go out and all out to smash you on the other cheek, which means that they have disgraced themselves, or they have to use their left hand in a backhanded slap, which is the same thing. So basically, this first example is an example of what advice you might give to very vulnerable, very marginal people of how to put off guard someone who has a great deal of power over them. It's a very creative form of nonviolence. The second one is equally provocative. And just to remind you, it says, if anyone would sue you and take your coat, let him have your cloak as well. Well, a better reading, a more accurate reading of these words would be, if anyone would sue you and take your outer garment, give them your inner garment as well. Now, what's at stake here is in the Old Testament laws, in Deuteronomy, there are provisions for the poor. And the provisions include that someone has the right to take the outer garment of the poor who are as a sign that they are owed something by that poor person. But they have to give it back by the end of the day because it's probably the only thing they have and it gets cold at night. Okay? So this is a situation where essentially the poor are being dragged before the courts all the time. And who wins those battles? Do poor people ever win those battles? They never did in the time of Jesus. They rarely do in our own time. So basically what Jesus is telling them to do is go ahead, go before the court, and when they win, as they always do, and they take your outer garment, then take off your underwear, strip yourself naked, and stand before the court. And in a shame and honor culture of this time, the one who is naked isn't shamed. The one who views the nakedness is. It's as if you've taken my land. I mean, it's a very powerful statement. You've taken my land. I've sold my kids into slavery, which is what happened. This would be a very, very common picture of life for poor people at the time. You've taken my cloak. Damn it, take my underwear too. Be a powerful way of exposing, again, a system that is crushing the poor in a way that actually shames the person that's saying, all right, I'm going to take your undergarment too. All right, the third example is fairly similar, only this time, and specifically, it says, if anyone makes you force you to go one mile, go with them 2 miles. Anybody know what that's about? Who might? Palestine is this kind of central location. You've got soldiers going through all the time. This is what's going on. And the Romans had laws. You're not working. You're sitting there. I have the right as a Roman soldier to tell you, you carry my pack. Pack weighs about 80, 90 pounds. You have to carry it. Well, this created so much indignation within Palestine that the Romans actually passed some laws limiting to 1 mile. Can only make them go 1 mile. If you make them go any more than that, then you can get in trouble. There were fines, there were other things at stake there. So Jesus is saying, go the mile, and then go the second mile. Well, you can imagine the soldier going, what do you mean go a second mile? If she carries my pack the second mile, are they going to turn me in? Am I going to get in trouble here? Am I going to have to pay a fine? Am I going to get in trouble with my own? It's creative, nonviolent resistance aimed at attempting to put off guard those who are powerful. One other clarification here that Wink makes. He says, the word here that we use for do not resist one who is evil, in almost all of its other usages in the scripture, means do not resist with violence. It's not do not resist. It's do not resist with violence. Now, one kind of bridge statement here from a previous conversation this week is just to remind you that the new Jesus scholars say Jesus was probably a disciple of John, but that John held this apocalyptic vision of God. John's vision of God was the classic vision of a vengeful coming of God. And Jesus breaks with that and says, no, the kingdom is not something that's future that's going to be brought about by a vengeful coming of God. The kingdom is here and now. Everyone can participate in it. Everyone can build it. And the way we do it is we imitate God. We live as though God is in charge, not the rulers, not the empires. And that vision of God, I think, for Jesus, was very much an understanding of a nonviolent God. And it's a nonviolent coming of God that saves us and that Jesus lives out in his life and practice. Okay, any questions about that before I talk about eaten by dogs? Any comments or still tracking after? I feel like I'm talking a lot. I hope your silence is because you're just eagerly waiting to get to the punchline and I'm not boring you, so.
Just a comment.
Yeah.
I think Wink was a little more explicit as to why that was the unclean hand.
What did he say? Remind me.
I think that's the one you used when you didn't have any tissue paper.
Oh, could be. Could be.
It still is in parts of the world.
Uh-huh. And it was very much of a right-handed culture anyway, where, I mean, we've had a lot of prejudice against left-handed people in this country up until not too many years ago, until they became good pitchers, I think, is my theory.
But also, wasn't there a custom whereby someone who was elite just would not touch another person with this part of the hand because they were beneath them, and if they did, have to have contact. They wouldn't want anything other than...
Well, and I'm sure within the purity laws and purity codes, you don't go around touching people that are below you on the social pyramid very often. I mean, there's all kinds of things about that. That's why you don't touch a leper. I talked about leprosy last time, but you don't... It's because when you do that, then you have to go through a whole bunch of things to get yourself ritually pure. And so there's probably a lot of that stuff going on, too. Okay. All right. Just a couple of, two or three more things to stress, and then we'll open it up for conversation. One is, just remember that crucifixion was Roman's state terror. That's what it was. It was designed to intimidate. It was designed to silence. And part of crucifixion, again, was to leave the body in a public place. Because you leave a body in a public place and it's out there for days and it's being eaten by dogs and wild birds, it sends a pretty powerful message that you don't resist. The purpose of it is state terror. It's intimidation. It's to silence any kind of protest. That's the first thing. Second thing to say, it's very interesting. Rome had three ways that it disposed of the bodies of the people it decided to kill. Any idea what those three were? Crucifixion was one.
Burning
was another. We had that in an earlier example.
Stoning?
Well, after the body, you still do that. But stoning actually was more a religious, I think that was more of a religious punishment. But, well, the three are fire to fiction, and throwing them to wild animals, feeding literally the body. So when you have those stories about the lions and stuff, they served other purposes as well. And what might a reason for that is simply, how do you dispose of the bodies? I mean, how do you get rid of bodies? Well, you burn them, that's one way. You feed them to animals, that's another way. You crucify them and leave them in public places, and then they get eaten by animals, that's another way. That's why, despite very good historical evidence that, again, of the crucifixion of 2,000 people following the rebellion in Sepphoris, and many, many, many other examples, in all of the archaeological digs, there's only been one body found that testifies to crucifixion, because they were all eaten by wild dogs and birds. So that leads to Crossan, back to Crossan, from Richard Horsley to Crossan, back and forth, and to others. But what Crossan says is, another thing we have to realize, I didn't mention this, is that the culture in which Jesus lived has been referred to by some as a burial culture. Being buried was really, really, really important. And so to not be buried, to, as part of a crucifixion, to have your body eaten by wild animals, was part of the state terror. It was part of, I don't know how to even say it, of trying to wrench every sense of dignity from that person and that person's followers or friends. It was the ultimate in humiliation. And what Crossan says is, if you read the different accounts, you'll see that the earliest accounts make no mention of the burial of Jesus, the earliest historical records that we have. And then you've got Mark. And Mark creates the story of, what was it in Mark? I think in Mark it's that there was someone on the council who was sympathetic and thereby was able to get the body down. And then is it Luke or Matthew? They invent a rich person. What they're trying to do, basically what Crossan says is, the followers of Jesus weren't around. They had fled, right? So those who really cared about this temporarily are out of the picture. They're gone, because otherwise they'd be up on the cross with Jesus. They're gone. And the people who would care, there was a law that the Romans, Roman soldiers, after, if the body died in time, if the person died in time, there was a law that said that the soldiers would take the person down on the cross, from the cross, and put them in a shallow grave. Well, but the same fate happened anyway, because you can see how eager the chipmunks are out here. We can get a sense of what the dogs were probably like. Okay, you go through that, and you've got different stories about being created by these writers of how to get Jesus buried, because it's a burial culture and it's really important, and you're making claims about your experience of this person, this Jesus, as the Son of God, and how can you explain the Son of God being eaten by dogs? It's a pretty tough one. And by the time you get to the Gospel of John, go home and read that tonight, you have a royal burial. Huge tomb, anointment, what you would expect for a burial of a rich, honored person is what you get by the Gospel of John. Keep in mind, I've talked about the Gospel of John as the robotic Jesus Gospel in the past. So let me just see if I can find a summarizing quote here from Crossan. Says, at the start, as history's real terror, were his enemies and the dogs. At the end, as faith's unreal apologetics, were his friends and the spices. You move from history to John's account. But no amount of apologetics can conceal what their intensity only confirms. With regard to the body of Jesus, by Easter Sunday morning, those who cared did not know where it was, and those who knew did not care. Now, it seems to me, two last comments. One implication of this for me is that in the next room, we're having a series on evil. I think this original historical picture of what happened to Jesus really forces us into a much more direct accounting of evil, of the domination system, in our own time and in Jesus' time. In order to make sense out of the life and death of Jesus, we have to take that evil very seriously. Second, it seems to me that it raises some profound questions again about how the scriptural stories come to us. And that can be very, very intimidating in terms of implications for people's faith. My own view is that there are possibilities out of this to, in fact, deepen faith. And that's the subject of tomorrow afternoon, is what are some of the implications of what we've been talking about. But the post-resurrection narratives, which we'll talk about tomorrow, really have much more to do with some of the priestly followers of Jesus searching their scriptures to make sense out of why Jesus was killed. And the last thing I'll say is that for me, these stories make the miracle of faith more real, more miraculous, because the story that we have is that Jesus revealed God to us in more clearly than anyone who came before. That's the claim of the early Christians. Jesus revealed God to us more clearly. Then what that forces me to do is to take the real life of Jesus seriously. What did he do? How did he live? And how must we link that to our actual Christian faith? But the claims of faith grow out of, and I'll talk about this next time, Crossan talks about how in the earliest literature, there wasn't a reference to resurrection. In the earliest literature, there's a reference to the experience of the living Jesus. Not the resurrection story, not the post-resurrection appearances. Those, Crossan would say, are fictional. But what's not fictional is that real experience that people had, that here this Jesus who revealed God to us in new and decisive ways gets murdered by the Romans. But the life experiences of the people who regroup around him were the experience of the Holy Spirit, the experience of the ongoing living Jesus. And it's that which gave rise to faith. And what we have, I think, is a lot of storytelling among the gospel writers, searching their scriptures for how to explain this, how to explain that Jesus was killed. And their principal explanation that they came up with when they searched their scriptures was the idea of the sacrificial lamb, the atonement, the scapegoat. Those are the images that they built on to explain. But Crossan would say, those aren't historical. What is historical is the actual life and practice of Jesus that Rome couldn't kill. And that the experience of the living Jesus is what gave rise to the faith that we now all share. So I'll stop there and just see what kind of, yeah.
I read an article this summer, actually, on the topic of Jesus being eaten by dogs. And you're from Minnesota?
Yeah.
It's possible that you came across the article. It was very critical of the
Jesus scholars.
Jesus scholars, yeah. Right, who are, I believe probably those books that you were talking about even. And it was written by a professor at Bethel College.
Oh, I haven't seen that one. I was thinking it was, but go ahead.
Well, anyway, I guess I can't remember exactly what the critique was, but it seems like it had something to do with if you're calling into a question the resurrection story, then it's easy to make a leap and say that Jesus was a historical figure but nothing more. And how would you respond to that?
Well, that response is a very common response among people who are critical of the Jesus scholarship and even what they're trying to do. And if you want, you know, the best articulate statement against is being written by a man named Luke Timothy Johnson, who's written a book called The Real Jesus, and he just trashes these Jesus scholars. And the point I would like to make, they certainly have the right to do that, and they have a logical foundation for doing so. Essentially, their arguments are either, one, we can't know. That's one argument, we can't know. The other is, two, it doesn't matter. And so a lot of their claim is, no, what we need, all we need is to discern or to take seriously what these early Christian communities said about Jesus. That's the foundation of our faith. Really everything that's gone before in this session and what I've talked about today is really my response to that criticism. And my response in a nutshell would be, I think we have divorced Christianity from the life of Jesus to our own peril. And I think part of the hope for the world, I mean, this is a very strong statement, but really the hope for the world, the hope to the world is being destroyed through the gap of the rich and the poor, and it was a gap that Jesus had something to say about and addressed. There are so many things like that where I believe that the actual life and practice of Jesus, which again, I believe reveals God to us in new and decisive ways, that we're turning away from that because it's simply a message that's too hard for us to hear or too discomforting. Someone else said, yeah.
Well, it seems to me that when these scholars say it, the important thing is the life, the people, the faith, the people who lived after Jesus, believing that he was alive, is a sort of a cop-out to cover up the fact that they've already destroyed the basis for which they could believe that he was alive. So it seems to me that they're sort of just finding a way out to sort of appease people.
Well, you know, another, if it's in another one of their criticisms of like Luke Timothy Johnson, is that he says, well, these new Jesus scholars, really they're trying to create a Jesus in their own image. And Crossan's response to that is, that's a temptation for all scholarship. And that's something that we have to acknowledge and factor that in as a variable, that we have to be very careful not to create a Jesus in our own image. But then Crossan would turn around and say, that's exactly what many of these other scholars have done. That's what we've done. We've turned Jesus into someone that we can easily live with, that doesn't challenge us too deeply, that doesn't force us to examine it. You know, one other example, I've given this in the past, and I'll talk about it next time, but I'll give the example of the Lord's Supper again. Crossan says, you know, the Lord's Supper is an early Christian, that ritual is an early Christian ritual that's based on two things. It's based on the actual life practice of Jesus, who was constantly eating and drinking with people, building community around the necessity of food and sustenance. So it's the memory of that combined with a ritual that commemorates his death and the experience of the living Jesus in the aftermath of his death. That's what we have. It's not a historical account. He didn't gather on the night before he was betrayed in Jerusalem. He didn't have the self-knowledge that this is going to be forever ritual. It's a ritual written because it had a historical basis in the life and practice of Jesus. Now, the reason I think that's important, I don't want to throw away the ritual, but I think I would like to re-ritualize it. Because in a world of massive hunger and poverty and inequality, Christians are the world's dominant economic group. And there's something incongruous about being able to go to that table and not take the problem of real hunger, real poverty seriously. And I think if we would re-ritualize that Last Supper and bring back the actual life practice of Jesus, it offers us profound hope for actually responding to the issue of hunger and poverty in our own time.
But the really bottom line of what he's saying is that there is no resurrection. We have no resurrection to look forward to.
No, that isn't the bottom line of what he's saying. We can get to that next time. I don't think that's what he's saying. He is saying that that resurrection is one metaphor for understanding the living Jesus. And it's the one that we get from Paul. And he talks about, you know, maybe why. And I'll leave this for next time, because one of the things I want to talk about is why I brought up on several occasions, where did the idea of resurrection come from, and why was resurrection such a central theme? Well, it had to do with the experience of the people that Jesus, in fact, was living. But it also had to do with, it was another way of understanding that in the past, when the faithful were being persecuted and being killed, that's where the idea of resurrection emerges. And so you have Jesus, the revealer of God to us, being killed, and that it just deepened that sense of resurrection. So no, I don't think that he would say, no, the resurrection didn't happen. He would say it's one of the ways to understand the living Jesus. And unfortunately, it's the only one that we ever hear about because Paul is so dominant. Yeah, one more.
Even though the Romans may have crucified thousands of people, I mean, maybe those people were, their bodies were eaten by dogs, I don't find that compelling enough to dismiss the four accounts in Scripture of Christ's experience being buried and rising, buried in a tomb and rising. I just don't find enough there to dismiss the other story.
Well, and maybe it's not important to, but I would encourage you to at least look at Crossan's argument, because he looks at how each of the stories, I mean, we have four different stories, and each of the stories gets us further and further away from crucifixion as state terror, and more into Christian proclamation, until, as I say, you have very different accounts in Mark and in John. So which one are you, which one do you choose to believe? They're extremely different. Extremely different. By the time you get to John's Gospel, it is a royal funeral with anointment and so again, I don't want to I know there are a couple people talked to me after an earlier session, and they just said more or less what they said, maybe without these words, was I think it is important. It's always been important to my belief that Jesus was born of a virgin, that he walked on the water, and that's kind of, this faith has served me well for 55 years, so I don't want to come in here anymore. And I think that's fine. I do. But I think that if we look, the only reason, as a person of faith, the only reason for me to take some of the issues posed by Crossan seriously, including his understanding of crucifixion and what likely maybe happened to Jesus' body, and why we have to take a critical look at the gospel accounts of that event, are because I think within that search we find ways of deepening our understanding of faith, even deepening our understanding of the meaning of resurrection. For me, I get very enlivened and empowered by the idea of the experience of the living Jesus. That's a very powerful metaphor for me, and one, I don't know if it is for you, and maybe it's, well, I don't know, that's probably enough said, but just take a look at his argument, maybe you'll find it convincing, and maybe you won't.
That's why I appreciate hearing it.
Oh, no, but I mean, he does it much better than I did it, I'm sure. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.